A U.S. military commander says the most important way to stop Yemen's Houthis from attacking Red Sea shipping is to block Iran from rearming them. Our Pentagon correspondent gives her assessment of the U.S. interdiction strategy.
It's a very difficult thing to do, and we also know that these interdiction efforts have been few and far between.
As Iranians endure an inflation crisis, many resort to desperate methods to put food on the table. Iran's purge of dissent in higher education is intensifying. We talked to a former Iranian university professor ousted last year while on a trip abroad.
The most painful thing that has happened to me and to my family is that I could not say goodbye to them.
And Iran escalates a crackdown on Instagram users who sell goods and services deemed un-Islamic. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthis have carried out their first deadly strike on international shipping since mid-November when their onslaught began. A missile fired by the U.S.-designated terror group struck a Liberian-owned bulk carrier in the Gulf of Aden on March 6th, killing three crew members. The U.S. and its allies have been striking the Houthis since January to try to stop those attacks. But the chief of the U.S. Central Command, General Eric Kurilla, told a congressional hearing on March 6th that the most important thing is to deny the Houthis' ability to resupply from Iran. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb asked Defense Department Press Secretary Major General Pat Ryder on Tuesday whether the U.S. has increased its efforts to interdict those Iranian supplies. This was his response.
If there are these illegal shipments of arms, capabilities, weapons, that we have a responsibility to interdict those to prevent them from getting into the hands of terrorists. I mean, as you know, this is something, for example, that we've seen Iran sponsor in the past. It's certainly something that, you know, that they do to try to provide capabilities to the Houthis. And so we will continue to work closely with partners in the region to help deter and prevent that from happening.
I spoke to Carla Babb after that press briefing and asked how effectively the U.S. has been pursuing that strategy.
Well, we know that the U.S. military has been getting after and trying to find Iranians supplying the Houthis whenever they can, but it's a very difficult thing to do. And we also know that these interdiction efforts have been few and far between over the last few years. I mean, just think about the number of announcements that have been coming out recently on interdiction efforts. There have been some, but there have been very few. And so officials will talk to members on the Hill or they'll talk to reporters and they'll repeat over and over that while they feel like striking inside Yemen and hitting targets is making a difference because they know what they see and they are hitting what they see. The real issue here is they don't know the denominator. They don't know how many weapons that the Houthis have that the Iranians have been supplying them with year after year after year. And so it's really hard to know exactly how much you have been deterring the Houthis when you don't know how much total that they have. And so that is a problem with interdiction. And that's why I think the General Eric Kurilla, the head of U.S. Central Command, said that the absolute most important thing is to prevent them from getting new supplies, because as he pointed out, the Houthis are not building all of these things from scratch. They're putting together pieces, they're assembling them. They do not have all of these weapons just out there in Yemen.
What do we know about the kinds of weapons that Iran is supplying and resupplying to the Houthis?
Well, I mean, anything to make these missiles, like the inertial navigation systems to put in the missiles, the engines to make medium range ballistic missiles. I mean, all of these things have to be supplied by Iran. And that is why when you saw the latest interdiction effort that the U.S. made, when they put out pictures of this ship that they were able to stop and confiscate the weapon pieces in there, you could see what was clearly like engines for a missile in one of the pictures. You could just see that that's exactly what it was. So it's interesting that, you know, we should point out that Iran says that it does not supply the Houthis with these weapons, but there is repeated evidence to the contrary by these interdictions that have been done. Another thought that officials have been telling me and some analysts have been telling me is that, you know, the U.S. is trying to stop and interdict these weapons by sea, but there may be a point in time where partnering with Oman and having a way to stop any sort of ground transfer from Iran to Oman, the smuggling into Oman, and then to get to Yemen. That may be an effort that the United States has not put a lot of resources in that may be helpful in the future.
And can you tell us how successful the Houthis have been in the last couple of days regarding their own campaign to disrupt Red Sea shipping and to, you know, harass U.S.-led forces in the region?
Well, the absolutely awful fact is that three crew members of the bulk carrier True Confidence, that's a Liberian-owned bulk carrier, they died in the Gulf of Aden because a missile hit their ship, and others were critically injured as well. So they, the Houthis, I imagine, are feeling pretty good about themselves because they actually hit one of their targets and caused a death. It was the first fatal strike by these Houthis. Since then, we have still seen missiles and drones being launched into the Red Sea. And the U.S. just knocked out a couple just yesterday, just on Monday. And still, they're preparing more to launch. I was reading a press release from U.S. Central Command, and again, on Monday, there were multiple strikes carried out against more than a dozen Houthi missiles ready to launch, and even an unmanned underwater drone. So they are still trying to push their cause. They are still trying to disrupt international shipping. And so on the U.S. side, yeah, I have pressed this building several times before saying, okay, well, if they're still hitting ships and they're still able to launch missiles at international ships, why is the U.S. not doing more? And this building has said the U.S. is doing more, and they've put together a coalition that also needs to do more. And they are pointing at the international community and saying, you know, we're not the only ones with skin in the game. In fact, a lot of experts will say that when it comes to that shipping lane, very rarely would anything that ends up in the United States actually go through those waterways. So the U.S. is really there just to protect the idea of freedom of navigation and to support its allies.
Well, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, thank you very much for that update and speaking with Flashpoint Iran.
You're welcome.
An Iranian state-approved news site says consumers in some parts of the country have been waiting in long lines to buy meat at government-regulated prices to mark the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Images appearing to show those long lines outside of city markets have appeared online in recent days. In a news report published Tuesday, Khabar Online said the long lines for price-controlled meat reflect the bitter reality of Iran's rampant inflation and other weak economic indicators. I discussed Iran's inflation crisis in last week's show with Sara Bazubandi, a researcher at the German Institute for Global and Area Studies. In the second part of that conversation from March 1st, I asked Bazubandi how Iranians are obtaining food when they don't have enough cash to spend.
Yeah, so it depends on which segment of the society you're looking at. There are various ways that people found around this. One is in the rural areas, the people with access to agricultural land, they might be able to maintain some sort of, stable staple of food consumption. Of course, the consumption basket is completely different than somebody who lives in the urban areas, but, this is one method. The other method, and I've seen also, again, reports at the domestic media level about people buying food on credit, like, from their local butcher or from the local baker or from their local corner shop, buying food on credit. There is also a significant rise of first-time crime and burglary. There is a phone snatching.
Really?
And, increasing breaking and entering into houses.
So people are resorting to theft as well.
Yes, exactly. Theft, prostitution, drug dealing, all sorts of unfortunate ways of generating income. And to add to that, there is a very serious increase and a visible increase of fraudulent activities at the individual level. Of course, corruption at the institutional level always existed, but these Ponzi schemes across the country, members of families trying to rip each other off, local businesses trying to rip their community off. And, it's basically Ponzi schemes and theft and prostitution is just become a part of day-to-day lives in that country, unfortunately. As people are pushed into poverty, they find illegal means and ways of generating income.
What is the Iranian government doing about this, if anything, and how effective are its measures?
The most important thing that they do is that they deny. If you listen to the statements made by officials, Iranians at the most senior level, all to the MP levels, you will hear that they are praising the government's actions and the effectiveness of their economic policies. So there is a huge degree of denial. At the same time, what they're doing is the government's action is creating this environment. One of the most important underlying causes for inflation in Iran is this unlimited, reckless issuing money practice that the central bank has been pursuing for years. Liquidity has constantly increased, liquidity in circulation has constantly increased in Iran over the past decades. And during Rouhani was really an issue, and President Raisi has made it even worse, and his central bank has made it even worse. What they've also done is they have eradicated the subsidized foreign exchange rates for some of the imported items, which was supposed to save the government from unnecessary cost and make more resources available to necessary items. But in practice, that hasn't happened. So cutting down on subsidized foreign exchange rate has meant imported food items, necessary food items like wheat and rice and so on, also have increased quite significantly. Iran is going through a serious water shortage. So it increasingly has been relying on import of food. And when the government cuts down on these subsidized foreign exchange rates, it means that imported food items, necessary food items, are also increasing, the price increases. So what the government is doing is mostly they deny and they implement policies that are increasing inflation. That's all there is to it, in my opinion. They haven't implemented any serious measure that shows that they are trying to keep inflation under control.
Well, Sara Bazubandi, research fellow at the German Institute for Global and Area Studies, speaking on the line from Hamburg, Germany. Nice of you to be with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for having me. No, thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. A global network of Iranian dissident academics and students says Iran's Islamist rulers have been escalating a purge of universities in recent months, forcing more teachers out of their jobs for expressing dissent. The International Community of Iranian Academics said last month that more than 200 professors have been dismissed from Iran's universities since 2022. One Iranian professor who was dismissed last year from northern Iran's University of Mazandaran is Farshid Nowruzi Roshnavand. Now living in France, I asked him by phone how he ended up there.
First of all, I would like to thank you, dear Maike, for your kind invitation. When the mass uprising started in Iran, I was serving as the vice dean of the Faculty of Foreign Languages at the University of Mazandaran. Well, at that time, the majority of the students went on a strike to show their solidarity with women life freedom movement. I was contacted four times by security and high-ranking authorities of the academic institution I was working in to provide them with the names of the students who did not participate in the courses. Well, I could not do that. I said, no, I will not cooperate with you on that matter. And then I stepped down from my position as the vice dean of the faculty. After 3 weeks, they fired me from my teaching position as well.
How surprised were you when that happened? Did that come as a shock?
So I was really shocked because I was invited to a conference in Paris. I was in Paris and the faculty was informed, the university was informed, and I was supposed to have my classes online. So one morning when I wanted to log in, I noticed that the system does not work for me. And then I understood that there is a problem. And they told me that I had no more access to the academic institution's website and so on and so forth. And then they told me that they had fired me.
And now you were in Paris, as you say, when it happened. So did you end up staying there or did you go back to Iran and then leave again?
No, I preferred not to go back to Iran because, frankly speaking, I was afraid of my safety. And thanks to the POST program, which is launched to help scholars at risk, I managed to find a postdoctoral position at Université Paris Créteil UPEC right now, and I'm now a fellow scholar there, a researcher.
So can you tell us how difficult was it to realize that while you're on a work trip to another country, to France, that this happens to you and you can't go back and you basically have to move your life without even having planned to do so? How tough was that for you?
Well, I have to admit that it was very tough. And the most painful thing that has happened to me and to my family is that I could not say goodbye to them because I had no information about what was going to happen. So it is not easy. I really miss them. And it is now 15 months that I have not been able to see them.
How are they doing since you've been living in France?
I'm especially worried about my mom because she's old. And my sisters tried to conceal the fact that I was not able to get back to Iran from my mom. And they always told her that he's going to come back, I don't know, in 2 months, in 3 months. But now I think that she knows that I would not be able to come back soon.
Well, it sounds like a very difficult situation for you personally. Now, are you able to keep in touch with other students that you used to teach, with other teachers that you used to work with? And if so, what are they telling you?
Well, yeah, I'm in contact with my students. I'm in contact with my fellow teachers. And in general, I should say that they are really disappointed because the regime knows that the only way to contain subversive voices is through repression. So repressive measures have unprecedentedly increased at the university. Some of my colleagues were summoned to the intelligence organization. Some were threatened not to continue the activism. And the majority have chosen, or I better say, were forced to choose silence. So I should say that in terms of sociopolitical activism, the academic institutions in Iran are largely dead, unfortunately. And compulsory hijab continues to be harshly imposed on both students and teachers.
Now, in a recent panel discussion in which you participated in December with other Iranian academics who have been forced to live in exile, you said that there's a phenomenon of some students and teachers who are affiliated to the government spying on people whom the government deems suspicious. How big a problem is this?
It's a serious problem. It's a serious problem. I can say pro-government, the students who work for intelligence and security agencies and are paid. It is the job. So according to my latest information, at least 120 students at the University of Mazandaran inform on the so-called subversive actions. And I think that's the same in other academic institutions in Tehran and maybe other big cities. And because the government strictly monitors the employment process of university teachers, I have to admit that right now there are many, unfortunately, many pro-government teachers working in academic institutions in Iran. I cannot say that they are the majority, no, but there are many.
That was Farshid Nuruzi Roshnavand, a former English literature professor at the University of Mazandaran. We'll have more of that conversation in next week's show. A report published last week by French network France 24 says Iran's cyber police are increasingly targeting Instagram businesses whose products and services they deem un-Islamic. I contacted the article's author, Iranian journalist Ershad Alijani, and he told me by phone that Iranian fashion designers, tattoo artists, makeup artists, and others have seen cyber police take over and shut down their Instagram accounts at unprecedented levels in recent months. Alijani reached out to some Instagram users worried about their accounts being targeted as well. I asked him how he managed to connect with them.
Many of them hesitated to answer my messages because I'm a journalist, I'm working in media outlet abroad. Some others politely declined, which is quite understandable because they don't want to draw unwanted attention to their business, which is their only source of income. But some others were willing to answer my questions. Of course, as always, we have taken strict measures to publish their accounts or photos of these pages in a responsible manner, so that the Islamic Republic cannot trace these photos back to these pages. If you verify our article, you would see we have blurred lots of parts. We even deform some of the photos. The security of our sources is a top priority for us at France 24.
So of those Instagram owners in Iran who were willing to chat with you, what were they telling you about their concerns when they see the pages of other people being shut down and these messages from the Iranian government being posted on those pages?
They were afraid, but many Iranians, especially new generations, they do not care about Sharia or hijab or religion in general. So they live their lives on social media, at least as they please, like a teenager or young person in Paris or, I don't know, Berlin. On the other hand, due to the terrible economic situation, most young people rely on their small businesses on social media. And I must admit, they are very brave. But about how they work, I asked one of the girls who make lingerie and sell it on Instagram. You can imagine how un-Islamic the pictures are. That aren't you afraid of the cyber police? And she told me, yes, I'm afraid. I'm so terrified that I avoid even thinking about the situation that they are after me. But I have forbidden myself to bend over and give up my lifestyle out of fear. I have done nothing wrong. The regime is wrong.
What is your sense of the capacity of the Iranian cyber police and Iran's other security agencies to actually crack down on all this activity? Because as you were noting, there is a lot of it going on in Iran.
I think if they appear on the radar of the cyber police, it's not too difficult to find out who's behind these pages. If they are working with their name, all they have to do is search their name in their databases. Even if not, a fake account belonging to a cyber cop only needs to place an order there. At this level, the business owner has to provide a bank account if they are selling a product, or an address if they are offering a service like tattooing or massage. So it's not a big deal for a state. Then they are either arrested or simply summoned to a police station. And in a way, this is huge because there is a state cyber police whose priority seems to be the fight against these un-Islamic pages on social networks. So we can imagine that many pages fall victim to them every day. On the other hand, it's only a fraction. So there are thousands of these pages like this. And I can see that the regime's cybersecurity police could be overwhelmed. In 2022, there was one estimation that there are more than 500,000 of these online shops on Instagram. And I can imagine in 2024, there are much more than that.
So what do you think is going to happen going forward? Do you anticipate more resistance from these small business owners using different kinds of methods to try to avoid the scrutiny and the attention of the cyber police?
Actually, what I saw is it wasn't really a resistance or even a political agenda there. You know, they wanted to just live their lives as normal people. And unfortunately, I have the feeling that there is kind of a stalemate here. There are 20 or 30-year-old people who just want to live a normal life. And the other side, there is a brutal regime that will not let them. And that explains why every day somewhere in Iran, a group of people protest against something. Why almost every 2 years, there's a general protest and the regime kills, hurts, and arrests thousands of thousands to survive.
Irshad Alijani, journalist with RFI and the Observer Desk of France 24, speaking on the line from Paris, France. Thanks for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for this week. You can find this program and previous editions on Apple and Google Podcasts. If you're on the Apple app, please leave us a review. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you'll do the same next week for another Flashpoint Iran.